Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Dr. E. Michael Jones. Dr. Jones is a historian, a prolific writer, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Among his many books are The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, The Slaughter of Cities, and the most recent Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury. His books and a subscription to Culture Wars can be purchased at culturewars.com. Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Great.
Thanks for coming back on the show.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And, of course, last time we talked was late November, and we were discussing how the mainstream media was going to prevent Trump from winning. It turns out they weren't successful in that endeavor. His upset victory occurred back in early November, and left everyone apparently surprised. I think my own position was by late October, I was beginning to think that Trump was going to win because something had turned. What was your take on the election results and what it means? What is your take?
It was a repudiation of the oligarchs, a repudiation of political correctness, a repudiation of the state of the American empire, a repudiation of foreign adventurism and foreign politics, all of these things. That's what it was. That's what the historical situation was. There is an anti-globalist zeitgeist that is now sweeping the world. Began with Brexit. Trump is an example. It's sweeping through Europe now. Even Asia is going to have to come to grips with it. So that's clear. That's what it was. I said that all along during the campaign. You could see it. It was palpable in Indiana when Trump showed up at that rally. That's the one aspect of it. That's the aspect I kept emphasizing. I kept saying that was the wave and that Trump was the surfer on the wave. And he understood the discontent and he focused it and he won the election. So good for him. Everyone, I think men of goodwill, all had to come together and realize that Hillary Clinton was going to be a disaster, a complete disaster if she had been elected. She talked about putting a no-fly zone on over Syria because she had done it in Libya and she got away with it in Libya. So hell, if she did it in Libya, she can do it in Syria, right? Well, wrong, because we weren't eyeball to eyeball with the Russians in Libya. And that's what we were in Syria. And that went, and every report that came out of Russia after the election confirmed what I was saying, which was basically that Hillary's election would have been tantamount to World War III. So we dodged that bullet. That's great. But now we're in a new era. And this era is now going to focus on the part that I didn't focus on before, namely Trump and his personality. Now Trump, his personality is going to be important. before it was a vote against Hillary Clinton, it was a vote against the oligarchs and so on and so forth. And Trump was the man, is the surfer riding that wave. Well, now it's Trump is much more important, the personality of Trump and so on and so forth. And that's what we're seeing now, I think, with these the nominations.
Yeah, some people have observed that he's appointing the usual suspects, the crony capitalists that have made such a mess of things in the past few decades. A few of the names one thing, they're all billionaires, right?
Yes. We have the wealthiest cabinet in human history right now.
I think someone has said it's like $35 billion, I think, is the...
And rising, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So we need to deal with this, piece by piece. Okay, like he's nominating Goldman Sachs guys. Let's say just because you worked for Goldman Sachs 14 years ago, maybe you're a repentant sinner. Okay, there's more rejoicing in heaven when one sinner repents than when 99 are, saved. Okay, so maybe it's perfectly clear to me that there can be people in the CIA, for example, who are very unhappy with the way things were going, with the way our foreign policy had been basically taken over by Israel and so on and so forth. And that simply because of the fact that you were in the CIA should not disqualify you from taking a position. But I think the same thing should apply to Goldman Sachs. But on the other hand, we have lots of bad experience with appointing Goldman Sachs guys as head of the Treasury. Two examples would be Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner. What they did was atrocious. It was criminal. They should be in jail now for what they did. Obama completely capitulated to Goldman Sachs, offered up AIG so that there wouldn't be a lawsuit, and made them whole full face value. They should have taken a 10% haircut, okay, 10% at most. This is what happens with bankruptcy laws. This is what I said, Trump knows this. He's been through bankruptcy a lot. You take it, your creditors take a haircut. Goldman Sachs got made at full face value, and as a result, lots of people lost their homes because of their crappy mortgages, and the mortgage market has been propped up with inflated values that are killing the economy. So don't we take that into account? Shouldn't we take that into account when the name Goldman Sachs comes up again? I think we should, because the main problem with government is what they call regulatory capture, which means invariably you appoint the fox to be in charge of the hen house. Which is like, that's what it means to be, point someone from Goldman Sachs to be head of the Treasury Department. Both Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson represented the interest of Goldman Sachs. They did not represent the interest of the American people. If they had, Goldman Sachs would have been made to take a haircut. But they didn't. They were rewarded. They're given their golden parachute for doing this. And this is precisely the problem with government in the United States. It's government by the oligarchs and for the oligarchs, and that is precisely what got repudiated in this election. So how are we going? That's one issue. Okay. The second one, and in many ways more troubling, is all these military guys. Okay. Now, military guys are, we have a tradition of civilian control of the military, and probably for good reason. Now, I don't want to offend anyone out there, but military guys are notorious for being, single-minded. They haven't worked for a living for their entire lives. This whole situation was summed up best to me when I was in Detroit at the symposium on economics given by a friend of mine, and they bring this ex-military guy in, and he swaggers up to the microphone, and the first thing he says is, "We have to cut entitlements. There are too many entitlements out there." And I felt like saying, "Wait a minute, fella. You've been sucking on the government tit for your entire life, and now you have the gall to call Social Security an entitlement? You haven't, and then he starts talking about the free market. What do you know about the free market? If there's ever socialism incarnate, it's the military. Okay?
Yeah, the Iron Triangle in Pentagon, yeah.
There is no market here. There's no market. It's basically government pricing, you know, for, you know, $500 screwdrivers. That's what we're talking about here. A totally corrupt operation. And so we have a tradition of separate civilian control of the military, which has been completely eroded over time. And now here comes Trump, and he's nominating people like Mad Dog Mathis. Well, Philip Giraldi, a CIA guy, so there are some decent people in the CIA, wrote an article on this and said basically, look, these are all Iranophobes. Why are you appointing people like this? Why so many generals? And I think what we're seeing here now is a kind of profile that's emerging here of Trump as the character in an Ayn Rand novel. This is the profile that's emerging. You know, I mean, let's give the guy credit. They're good things. He seems to be working toward the bringing back jobs. You know, he flew into Indianapolis and gave about twisted carriers armed to bring the plants back. That's a great. That's good. That is why one of the reasons why I voted for the guy. Okay. But at the same time, it's like in baseball, it's or sports, which Donald Trump is going to show up. So we have all of these contradictions now that are emerging. And one of the biggest contradictions right now is in the foreign policy arena, where the main pillar of his foreign policy seems to be making peace with Russia. Okay, which is a good thing. And as I said, if it had been Hillary, we'd be at war with Russia right now. I shudder to think what would have happened by now, given that fact. Okay, so that's good. Okay, but okay, we're faced again with contradictions. If you're making peace with Russia, if you've got a foreign policy that we could characterize as, let's say, the America First foreign policy, since that's the idea you were channeling with the remaking the Midwest infrastructure, the industrial infrastructure, then why all this demonization of Iran? Why is this going on now? You can't, these are all of one piece. Syria is where we were at war with Russia and where I hope that we will soon achieve peace with Russia, but Russia and Syria are allied with Iran. Iran is the only group in the world that has boots on the ground fighting ISIS. So why are we suddenly demonizing Iran? Don't know. Don't understand this. Why are you hiring all these people? I'll tell you my greatest fear, okay? My fear is that he feels that in order to make peace with Russia, and here we're dealing with the Jews again, with the neocons who absolutely hate Russia. It was the neocons, the Jews, that got us into this very dangerous situation when Victoria Nuland, wife of Robert Kagan, orchestrated the coup d'etat in the Ukraine. That put us on the brink of nuclear war. And now we're trying inching back from that. Okay, now, is this the Trump who grew up in New York City, the Trump who made it to the top of the real estate heap in New York City, the guy who knows how to deal with Jews, must know how to deal with Jews? Is this the way you deal with Jews? In other words, we're going to ransom, we're going to offer you up, we're going to create the scapegoat, namely Iran, as a way of placating the Jews so that they leave us alone so that we can make peace with Russia. That's my fear.
Now, a couple observations. You mentioned Goldman Sachs and his appointment or his pick is this guy, Steven Mnuchin. That's how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
As the Treasury Secretary. And, of course, he's this hedge fund mogul and Hollywood producer. He has a history. You mentioned the mortgages. Now, he's one of the key characters in some in this mortgage debacle because he was pretty much able to take over that. It was an Indy Mac Bank that he was pretty much government paid him to take it over. Then he aggressively moved on the mortgages after he got that bank, you know, virtually for free. And he was able to foreclose all these properties. Of course, this is these same bunch who received trillions, you know, the Wall Street, the financial sector, which probably received trillions in bailouts and from the Fed after 2008. And I think Naomi Prinz, who actually is a Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs. Funny you mentioned Goldman Sachs. I was thinking, yeah, you won't see Trump appointing Naomi Prinz to any positions. And she's an example of someone who is from Goldman Sachs you wouldn't immediately dismiss. But she wrote the book, All the President's Bankers, talking about sort of this collusion, this culture of corruption, this crony capitalism. They all go to the same country clubs. They intermarry. You know, the Aldriches, the Rockefellers. And she gives a good historical perspective, sort of a cultural explanation for this thing, of this sort of this crony capitalist deal. But this is a guy who foreclosed on thousands of homeowners ruthlessly when he took over Indy Mac and opened up a new bank. All this was done with government money. And he made a fortune off it.
Yes.
She makes the point that just, you know, if you're going to accept the principle of bailing somebody out just for a fraction of what we spent bailing out the banks, you could have bailed out all the subprime mortgages in the country. You could have paid them off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You could have given them. You could. Let's. What was TARP? What, $1 trillion? $4 trillion? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
But you could have just basically okay. Give this to the people who own the mortgages. They can pay off the mortgage. Goldman Sachs or no, whoever owns, who's the fall guy? Goldman Sachs did not own these mortgages. Okay. Whatever bank owned the mortgages, they would have got paid off. The people could have stayed in their homes and everyone would have been happy. But we just don't do this. We don't put the money into the economy. We put it into the hands of bankers because capitalism is state-sponsored usury. That is the thesis of Baron Metal, and I think that's the reality.
Yes. Now, this, you get into. I'm about 400 pages into that book, and this kind of these guys, all the Medicis of our day. A good example of what a bad player the Goldman Sachs is. What they did in Greece, you know, with that fraudulent currency swap to hide all that debt, so Greece could borrow more money in violation of EU standards. I think they had a GDP to per debt ratio that they were to hide this debt with this swindle with this currency deal. I don't want to get into the details of the deal, but it basically was they created a fictional exchange rate to show, and they put this debt off the books for a few years to justify this loan from the EU bank. At the same time, Goldman Sachs collected fat fees for this stuff.
Right.
And then when Greece goes belly up, they can't pay the debt back. In come the international vulture capitalists to offer, you know, to buy up Greece's resources for a song. It's the deal, right?
Right. That is the deal.
Yeah.
That is the deal that the World Bank – it's called the Washington Consensus. It's basically a form of looting where you load countries down with debt, and then when they can't pay, which is always the case, sooner or later they can't pay, then they go in and strip their resources.
Yeah, it's the economic hitman model. You just load down with debt and the collateral – you know, the resources and the labor of the people, and you know local satraps or crony politicians take their cut. Nothing gets
right.
done.
Wait a minute. We voted against this,
mm-hmm.
didn't we? It wasn't this a repudiation of this, and now we got the same people coming in. It's going to be the old boss. The new boss is the same as the old boss. Is that what we're condemned to here?
Well, according to the WHO, that is.
And they should know, right?
Yeah. Meet the old boss, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Again, you mentioned the oligarchs. Now, I've had some analysis of the Trump's candidacy and eventual victory, and it made sense to me because he was able to put his hat into a ring, and not anyone could run for president. It wasn't just his sheer force of personality or his bank account that enabled it. Someone within the elite was supporting his campaign. Now, originally, I thought he was put up there to assure Hillary's victory. But I think perhaps in the course of the campaign, this explains some of the WikiLeaks and these things, what it exposed about the Clinton Foundation, Clinton herself, and the corruption. And maybe they determined that she was simply too corrupt, maybe too ill.
There was, I think, an insurrection in the FBI
and
the intelligence communities, and they were the ones that basically forced the hand of the FBI director, who had to come out. They said, basically, if you don't do this, we're going to have the New York Police Department tell what's on Wiener's laptop, and he didn't want that to happen, so he had to come out and do something. And he took it all back, but the damage was done.
That's what I think happened, and of course, more is leaking out. Now, we were privy to how much the mainstream media was colluding with the Clinton campaign. You know, we're having dinner parties and strategizing. And I think any keen observer of the political process, the mainstream media of the past few decades, wouldn't be too surprised by that, or the coverage that Trump received throughout the campaign was so biased. It was beyond dispute. But there's one thing that came out was even how the Clinton Global Initiative was working with shows like the Colbert Report to write scripts, and that's the latest
another
leak.
Another reason to get rid of your television.
Exactly, and so I'm saying even the comedy shows were in league, and these shows come across as being telling jokes to those and making fun of those in power, but really they're just servitors of those in power as well, just a different faction. Regarding Trump, see what you think of this. I've talked to a couple of people. They said that Trump. You have to study his background and his pedigree. He represents sort of someone told me this. I thought it made sense that sort of the actual mafia faction of the global elite, and this faction is somewhat patriotic and has local interests. And one of the reasons why they defected or went against the Clinton campaign was Obamacare, which really, really destroyed much of the remaining disposable income of the working class and middle class, who often go to casinos and hotels. And that's where Trump comes from, right? Of course, if you look at Trump, his background is Resorts International. That traces back to, Meyer Lansky and Mary Carter Paint Company and all that. So he has sort of this pedigree as well. I mean, of course, he's a billionaire, so he is the elite. But I'm trying to understand the machinations of the elite, of the oligarchs, because I don't think this elite is monolithic. I think there's factions.
No.
I think we saw it played out before our eyes in this campaign.
I think that what you're seeing now is pushback now.
Now that the
CIA is coming and saying, no, the Russians did it. It was the Russians who got Trump. The other faction in the CIA, the faction that wants to go to war with Russia. So it's going to be back and forth. You're going to see this internecine warfare here between the factions in groups like the FBI and the CIA.
And they're claiming that the WikiLeaks was Russia. And what they're saying was that they did this to hijack the election. So by Russia exposing the corruption of the Clinton campaign, they were hijacking the election. Now, that's their argument. Yeah.
That sounds like a stretch to me.
Yes.
If it were all untrue, wouldn't that have made an impression? Can't we evaluate whether it's true or not?
Yes.
I think basically what it came down to was a battle between WikiLeaks and the mainstream media, and the people went with WikiLeaks. And of course, the mainstream media, that's a severe wound because they don't control the narrative anymore. They don't.
Well, that's when we get into this fake news meme that's apparently catching on. Where they're pretty much, painting a very broad brush across what they call the alternative media as fake news. Of course, I think you're well versed in the history of real news, how fake it's been over the past century.
Yeah.
As if the New York Times, Washington Post, of some sort of paragons of truth and virtue when it comes to reporting.
That's different. That's different. That's their fake news.
Yes.
Their fake news is real news. That was all like what happened with the Hillary health issue. It was all lunatic fringe stuff until she collapsed trying to get into her van, and then suddenly it was okay to talk about it. This has happened over and over and over again. I think to get back to what I was trying to say about Trump, the focus is on Trump, and the question is, what is he? What are you? I'm not sure I buy this kind of the theory that you mentioned. I think of him more. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. He hasn't even taken office yet, and we're already judging him. I mean, as we should. But he reminds me of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a sense that he's like a traitor to his class, you know, who was confronted with the situation and did have to do some things. Okay, but those things were never really taken far enough, and he ended up basically saving the system. Maybe that's what Trump's going to do.
Well, we have to wait and see, I guess. We have no choice. But these appointments, I get, if personnel is indeed policy, they are troubling, but I'm not surprised by it. I can't say I'm disappointed.
No. Well, that's my optimistic moment.
Yeah.
My pessimistic moment is that Trump is John Galt. You know, and he's basically assembling the cast from an Ayn Rand novel here. You know, all of these people like Mathis, he's like Dirty Harry. You know, these are people that, you know, like, don't, I know what's wrong with this country. Just give me, let me at them. You know, it's that's what it's starting to sound like to me. You know, like Nietzscheans. You know, I mean, let's face it. The problem we have here is that the only people who are qualified, according to the standard criteria, are the people who are part of the problem.
That's right. Yeah, you have to be inside D.C. You have to advocate interventionism. You have to advocate the same war on terror policies that have been going on for the past 15 years. No one from the outside is let to come in and change things because it's the Washington consensus. Yeah.
So it's called regulatory capture, and this is the biggest problem in government right now. Now, so what he did with the EPA, that looks like the opposite of regulatory capture.
As if a critic of the EPA is somehow not qualified to take over the agency.
Yeah.
And as if the agency is, you know.
So here again, it comes down to this kind of Manichaean choice of good or evil. But the problem, and so when Mnuchin says there's too much regulation on Wall Street, I get nervous when Goldman Sachs people say that. Kind of stuff. Are you? So I'm. Wait a minute. Aren't we talking about the catastrophe that happened when we repealed Glass-Steagall? Isn't that what we're really talking about? But then again, you might make the case that, well, look, maybe Dodd-Frank was not the right answer to this thing. This is the problem you have here.
Yeah,
you're always swinging from one extreme to another. You got the country is a dialectic. So you're always being confronted with bad choices.
Well, economically speaking, I get this from reading your book, Barron Metal. Is the problem is there are some fundamental structural problems how the system is set up. One is, well, central banking, of course. The other is, well, is usury, which you may point in your book, how the oligarchs will impose low wages, either by low wages, you know, direct low wages, or through monetary debasement. Then they make up the difference with easy money, which is debt.
That's right. And it gets worse.
And it gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the history of the West, basically. Mm-hmm. It's like one long failure on the part of the Catholic Church to rein in the economy and explain to people, look, economics is part of moral philosophy. You have to use moral criteria when you're approaching the economy. The worst thing that ever happened was Isaac Newton and Adam Smith, who basically come along and they say, no, it's physics. You just have to balance two forces. That's precisely what I'm talking about when I talk about the dialectic. That was the system in America. You balance these two opposing forces. Newton called them gravity and inertia. Empedocles, the guy he got it from, called love and strife. And Adam Smith called it competition and self-interest. But they're all basically this two forces creating perfect circular motion, and so therefore you don't need the moral law. That has been a catastrophe for economics for 800 years. And I don't see anybody smart enough to figure this out. Don't see anybody on the horizon. because what we're seeing now is just the kind of jeering, I don't know, people who know, don't confuse me, don't ask me to read books. I know what's wrong. Just let me at them. You know, it's like Dirty Harry, you know, a room full of Dirty Harrys. Is that what we're going to get?
Well, that's because a lot, again, this, it's almost like every remedy is a, well, they're dealing with symptoms and not the cause.
Right.
Like I would argue that protectionist measures are dealing with a symptom and not a cause, because you're not, how can you have free trade when you have, the under the petrodollar system, when you have when you have currency swindles and all types of you know, manipulation of foreign exchange, of the forex markets and these things, you can't have that balance. And even under that theory doesn't work, you can't have a fair global economic system when one side is able to say capitalize an economy with you know, dollars that are printed up ex nihilo, and then they can pull it out and dump the market. Like kind of like what George Soros does.
Yeah.
And how can you have free trade in that environment? You can't.
No, free trade was always a bogus idea, because Britain always protected its manufacturers, and then at a certain point, because they did that, they reached the pinnacle of manufacturing power in the 19th century. Around the time of Ricardo and the corn laws. And then they said, well, we don't need it anymore. So let's have everybody engage in free trade, and we'll just call it free trade, and everyone will benefit. And that was the basis of Ricardo's book. Well, first of all, it's not true, okay? Because what they meant was, we are so powerful, our factories are so efficient and powerful, we can undercut anybody's price. So we don't need any protection. The other people need protection. And that's precisely what Friedrich List discovered in Germany. You'll get to that in a couple of hundred pages if you persevere.
I think that explains the 30 years war against Germany, doesn't it?
It does explain it.
I'm talking about the one in the 20th century.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Because basically what happened is that List understood the game the English were playing with their free trade rhetoric, because Germany suffered. The Germanys, okay, there's no Germany at this point. We're talking about the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, when Prussia was one of the co-victors in this thing. And suddenly, because England won, the Germanys, the principalities, are flooded with cheap English manufacturers, cotton and so on and so forth. And the avant-garde of this was the Jews. Jews would show up. Now, Germany, as I've said many times, had a tradition of protecting labor, of understanding this is the legacy of the Benedictines, the first group in the world who understood the value of human labor and based their philosophy, their lives on it. Ora et labora is their motto. And this contradicted the ancient world, much as I admire people like Aristotle. Aristotle, and especially the Romans, had a world that was based on basically usury and slavery, and that was the main cause of the collapse of the Roman Empire. So the Holy Roman Empire, which is a successor, is a repudiation of this, because Christians know that usury is sinful. And at that point, they, you know, everybody agreed. So, and then suddenly you have the advent of the money economy in Florence, the Italian city-states during the 15th century. And suddenly usury is a problem again, because people now need money, and the people who have the control of the money supply are the Jews, because they own the gold. And you want money from a Jew? Well, you can borrow it at 43 1/3% interest per annum, which means you're going to be ruined. And that's the gist of Merchant of Venice, that conflict. For I got the title for Baron Metal when Shylock says to Antonio, you know, I'm your friend, I'll lend you money. He said, friends don't lend money at interest. If it's, and Shylock says, my ducats, they can copulate faster than Laban's ewes and rams. Well, that's usury, except that it doesn't work, you know? So what happened is that List in the 19th century starts working, comes to America, links up with the protectionists there, And America is a place that got it half right. You know, Alexander Hamilton wrote basically two letters, one on manufacturers, which got it right, and one on banking, which got it wrong. Didn't see that this is a contradiction. You base your economy either on labor or on usury. And he wanted to have it both ways. Well, that's like America, isn't it? Isn't that like Trump? Isn't that what we're dealing with now? A room full of Dirty Harrys and John Galt's, who all know, because they're masters of the universe, know how things should be run, and are going to just perpetuate the mistakes of their forebears. So Liszt finally persuades the Germans, persuades me, obviously he dies, but Bishop von Kettler picks up the cry and basically persuades Bismarck that your enemy are the communists, it's not the Catholics, and Bismarck institutes Social Security and health insurance. And at that point, the Germans stop coming to America and they concentrate their workforce. And by 1910, they have surpassed England as the most powerful economic and industrial nation in the world. At this point, Lord Grey and Winston Churchill decide they have to destroy Germany. And so they lure the Kaiser, who is not listening to Bismarck anymore, into a war. And then we have what you refer to as the 30 Years' War, the First World War and then the Second World War, which is basically to destroy not just Germany, the nation, but Germany, the idea. And Germany, the idea is basically the idea of the Holy Roman Empire, which is that labor is the source of value. And that's where we are today. The English have won. If you talk to an economist and you mention Friedrich Liszt, he'll say, isn't that a Hungarian piano player?
That's right, because all they learn is Adam Smith and the Manchester School.
That's right. That's all they know. Like, economics began with Adam Smith, and then there was Ricardo, and there was Malthus, and then there was John Maynard Keynes. We don't like to talk to him about that much, but that's it. So it's a completely ethnocentric, myopic view of economic history, and we're all suffering as a result of that.
When you're trying to unravel these things, sort these things out, you have to understand is when you're dealing with macroeconomic policies, monetary policies, international globalism, these things, you're dealing with coercion. There are subtle ways of coercion, and that you can deprive people a whole range of choices and sort of lead them or create a very narrow range of opportunities that is, in essence, coercion. It just doesn't look like coercion. What I mean by that is if you debase the currency, okay, and someone's profiting off that inflation, I would say the financial sector is profiting off that inflation, you're creating vast concentrations of wealth, which lead to corporate concentration, which undermine local businesses, small, mid-sized companies, local agriculture. And pretty soon, what you have with the Roman Empire, you have a corporatist latifundia, right? What we have in this country now.
Well, actually, I think what happened is the opposite, actually. Because it wasn't inflation that was the problem. It was deflation that's the problem. That was deflation is what created the world that we're living in today. Nobody talks about deflation. Now, guess why nobody talks about deflation? Why do we always talk about inflation? Because inflation benefits the debtor, and deflation benefits the creditor. And the world is creditor is another word for oligarchs, and they run the world, including the economics department of every university. And so, therefore, they're always complaining about inflation because it eats away at their ducats, at their money, at their savings. Okay, this was precisely the problem, or at least that's the way Paul Volcker saw it when he was appointed head of the Fed. And Paul Volcker basically wrecked the economy to save the ducats of the oligarchs. That's what he did. It was a direct attack on labor. And when Ronald Reagan came in, he followed suit. The first thing Ronald Reagan did was fire the air traffic controllers to send a message. It's like, you know, the dictator comes in, he lines up the people against the wall and he shoots them all. That's what Reagan did with the air traffic controllers. And what you had was a catastrophe. And the Trump election is the reaction finally to that catastrophe, because that was basically sacrificing labor to usury. It was basically you took these companies, you enabled with the cheap money, the junk bonds that appeared on Wall Street, you created the era of the leveraged buyout, which meant so that you could the hostile takeover. You take over a company, an airline. It wrecked the airline industry, by the way, because hospitals, you name it, you take it over, load the company down with debt, and then you walk off with huge fees, stock options, that type of thing, and then the company goes belly up because it can't pay off its debt.
Now, that was wasn't that financed with Easy Credit, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So certain people are getting wonderful, great terms on loans, and then what they're doing is they're financing these leveraged buyouts, loading the country down with debt, taking the short term bonuses and all that. At the same time, or like today, where now you with the 0% interest rates for Wall Street, they're making money off the carry trade, the spread, whether buying treasuries or loaning it out to on credit cards, whatever. The consumer isn't getting the lower interest rates.
No.
Their savings accounts are being destroyed, with 0.01% interest. Yeah.
What you had with Paul Volcker? He raised. I think they raised the T bills were paying 20%. At a certain point, that destroys investment. Who in his right mind is going to risk his money by buying stocks where your return is dependent on the profit the company makes when you can get 20% guaranteed by the government? No one. So it killed investment. And then because it was so easy to make money. Just by parking it with T-bills, you gave an incentive to people to liquidate all these companies. Mm-hmm. Buy the company. Take the cash out, put it in T-bills. What company can guarantee you a 20% return on your investment? No company. That's not the real world. And, of course, it works for a while. I mean, usury is always like the guy who jumped off a 100-story building, and he goes whizzing by the 50th floor, and you say, "How are you doing?" He says, "Well, okay, everything's okay so far."
So far, yeah.
That's all.
When I read your article, I think it was it Twilight of the Oligarchs or the one where you wrote about Germany and the decision taken to deindustrialize or to move out the textile industry of Germany. Much of this seems to be – now, you can say the stage was set for this in 71 when they closed the gold window and they created the petrodollar, the artificially strong international dollar, because that's going to subsidize imports and make our exports less competitive. So you're going to create the macro environment for deindustrialization. But you have this decision taken in Germany too to deindustrialize, in this case, destroy a very competitive – profitable textile industry and move it to the third world. Is this part of this Rockefeller plan? Sort of this trilateralist plan?
I mean, this is the era of Henry Kissinger. The Rockefellers are alive. I mean, they're getting toward the end. I think that this whole idea of deindustrialization, I mean, it was from my reading, it was Helmut Schmidt who came up with the actual idea, who actually promoted this. It's Schloss. Chateau Rambouillet in France in 1975. But I think that the oligarchs, I mean, we're talking about a group of people. It could be the CFR. It could be the Bilderbergers. Yeah. We're talking about these people who are going to restructure the economy in their interest with kind of brutal measure. And I think that's precisely what Helmut Schmidt did. Helmut Schmidt was a very bright guy. He said that Jimmy Carter was a guy who knew everything and understood nothing. I think he was head and shoulders. I think he had a leadership role in that generation in terms of doing the oligarchs' bidding and changing the world to basically fit what the oligarchs wanted it to be.
Yeah.
It was an attack on labor in Germany. I also mentioned all those German porno films that all came into being around this time. Las Jucken Kumpel. Done by Franz Marischka, who ended up in working for MI5, a Jew from Austria working for MI5, and then went back to Germany. Do you think he did those porno films with Mission MI5 or maybe the mission of MI5? Because I just read a review in Spiegel just last night where it's a review of the book. There was a boxer from the Ruhr who wrote a book, Lasiok and Pumple. And the guy says, this is not about the workers' problems. This is about sex. Well, of course it is, because sex is going to distract you from your problems as a worker. And this was part of a psychological warfare campaign against labor that was being waged all throughout the 70s and come to its final culmination in, well, you name it, the Volcker had tenure at the Fed, Margaret Thatcher, the rise of Milton Friedman, all of these guys basically promoting usury now over labor.
And the left was bought out with free sex.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was what I said. Michel Foucault is the philosopher of every American university. He has basically written the default setting. So it's, let's say sympathy for victims. The outsider now is the guy you should be concerned about. Of course, homosexuals are the ultimate outsiders. Of course, Foucault himself was a homosexual. And basically, it's a marriage made in heaven. Because Foucault said, he's the leader of the left. Maybe you don't remember this, but there was a time when it was the French were the world's philosophers, like Jean-Paul Sartre. And then it was Foucault after Jean-Paul Sartre. And he was the leader of the left. You had to be a left-wing politician to be a philosopher, of course. It was the tradition of the French Revolution. And then we come to this crisis and basically 75, is it terrorism or not? Do we move into terrorism? Well, the left in France pulls back, the Baader-Meinhof gang takes over, and Foucault sees the kind of handwriting on the wall and says, okay, I'll make a deal. Let's make a deal in Trump's fashion, You give me unlimited sex and I'll stop criticizing your economic system. Well, that's the deal that's in place today. Mm-hmm. What is the left? The left is a joke. It's a standing joke. If you ever wanted an example of a standing joke in the recent election, try moveon.org supporting Hillary Clinton. She's the war candidate. Didn't you know that? Are you that stupid? Well, wait a minute. Maybe the fact that moveon.org is getting Soros money, maybe that helps your stupidity. Okay, but this shows you the complete bankruptcy of the left.
Yeah, I was in traffic the other day. I saw a car driving with a bunch of bumper stickers on the back, pasted all over the back of the car. And it's the coexist, the peace sign, arms are for hugging. And the next day was I'm with her sticker for Hillary on the car. Talk about cognitive dissonance, incoherence.
Well, these are the people in these elite circles, and obviously the Clintons are in these elite circles. He was anointed early on as a Rhodes Scholar. The oligarchs set this pattern way back in Scotland at the time of Adam Smith and David Hume. Both David Hume and Adam Smith, when you get to that chapter, you'll believe this, were orphans, did not know their fathers. These are prime candidates for oligarch takeover, because then the oligarch becomes your father figure, and you're an especially docile servant to this father figure, and you identify even closely, as opposed to the father who takes you aside and says, look, son, it's all bullshit. And this is the real story. They don't have people like that in their lives. They have basically just, you do what you're told. We now have another instance of this, our gay mayor in South Bend, Indiana, another Rhodes Scholar, another loyal servant of the oligarchs.
And the Rhodes Scholar system is an idea of making more or less the victims internalize the commands of their oppressors.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So here you have Foucault. A man who has a very problematic relationship with his father. That's why he's a homosexual. That is the cause of homosexuality. And now making a deal with the new Whig oligarchs, the university system, Berkeley hires them, and then suddenly the whole Foucauldian system spreads throughout the entire United States and then throughout the entire world. And our gay mayor, his father, Joe Buttigieg, is the man who introduced Foucault to Notre Dame. So what you see is this kind of seamless connection here between the Democratic Party and the Foucauldian academe. And the deal is basically what I said, you know, give me the right to act on my perverse sexual desires, and I won't criticize your economic system.
Yeah, and man has many masters as he has vices, as someone once said.
That's right.
Yeah,
and right, of course, and so we know.
And you mentioned Notre Dame. Of course, Notre Dame, it was Father Hesburgh that alienated Notre Dame from the church and kind of made this institution for that sort of cultural corruption that we now know today. It sits on a $12 billion endowment, but charges, what, like $40,000 a year? More
40.
Debt, right?
Try 60.
Is it
try
60.
60 pushing 70.
So all those working class Catholics that donated to build this institution in the last century.
Now the grandchildren get to go into debt, or their great-grandchildren, or whatever it was. Now, this is the whole – again, we're seeing the same pattern here. It's, you know, it begins with sexual liberation, and it ends with economic bondage. That's the system of control. The you know, we sweeten this whole package by saying you can screw whomever you want, whatever you want to do, and then you all end up being enslaved to usury, enslaved to your passions. That's the whole system.
That's the point you brought up in your book regarding the Florence and the Renaissance, how it was the Medici's attempt to provide bread and circuses to beguile the people as they're being robbed, as they're being thrown in the debt, correct?
That's right. Lorenzo peeked into the book and he just threw up his hands. It's over. It's over. We're ruined. And so he spent his time stealing from his family and stealing from the state treasury. And in order to distract everyone's attentions, he created the Renaissance. The Renaissance. And had one of the great painters of all time, Botticelli, as his personal propagandist painting. The famous painting, Primavera. Probably Botticelli's most famous painting. The one with Venus there. Florence, Fiorentina. It's the city of flowers. And so you have that figure there spewing flowers out of her mouth. That's the spring. Florence is the springtime of paganism. Paganism is coming back, and the man all the way on the left-hand side of the picture stirring the clouds, that's Lorenzo de' Medici. He's the guy, the rainmaker, as we say, both literally and figuratively in this whole thing. And so that was the beginning of basically using these cultural instruments as a way of distracting you from the fact that your government is stealing your money. Mm-hmm. And you're so Pete Buttigieg, our gay mayor, is featured in an article by Frank Bruni in the Wall Street Journal. I'm sorry, the New York Times. Sorry, New York Times, in which he says Bruni anoints Pete Buttigieg as the man who's going to be our first gay president. Okay, so what's the message of our first gay president to South Bend, Indiana? The good-paying jobs are not coming back. So therefore, go to the gay disco. And that is, oddly enough, the same message of Berlin. Wait a minute, this is uncanny, isn't it? Berlin gets a gay mayor. Klaus Wowereit. And what is Klaus Wowereit's message to the people? Wir sind arm, aber sexy. Same message. We're poor, but we're sexy. In other words, no good paying jobs anymore. You can work at Starbucks or whatever, or at the gay bar. But you can go to the gay disco in the evening, and that will help you forget about your problems.
Yeah, and NATO and the CIA will ensure a plenty supply of heroin too coming in from the from Afghanistan and the Balkans, right? Because you mentioned that also in Berlin in the '70s, there was a big influx of heroin being brought in from the Golden Triangle.
Yeah, that's another story too. At the same, yeah. So in Germany at this point, an uprising against the oligarchs. Mm-hmm. This is a violent Marxist uprising against the oligarchs. It's known as the Rote Armee Fraktion or Baader-Meinhof gang, and it's close to bringing down the government. And so at that point we have porno films suddenly being produced all over, and the plot of Las Jucken Kumpel is basically a guy who's a miner in the Ruhrgebiet, a coal miner. he's talking about how he's thinking of leaving and going to East Germany because they treat the worker better in this. And he walks into the canal, the bar pub where he hangs out, and the tender table, forehouse, and suddenly the whole idea of testing your wages evaporates, and all you're upset with is sex. The next step in that progression, I think, was heroin. Because heroin, Berlin, at the end, toward the end of the 70s, we're pushing the 70s with pornography. By the end of the 70s, Berlin, which is always the laboratory for the rest of Germany, suddenly flooded with heroin. Where did this come from? Where did this come from? Well, I think it came from Afghanistan. Because by this point, we know the CIA was involved in the Golden Triangle. They lost Vietnam, which means they lost their supply. They needed a new supply, and Afghanistan was their new supply of heroin. And so heroin flooded into Berlin, and they finally took cognizance of it. A book came out, Wir Kinder von Bahnhof Zoo, We Children from the Zoo Train Station. And that got made into a movie, and there's David Bowie in the movie kind of making an expensive, it's like the beginning of product placement in Germany. Except the product replaces heroin, and David Bowie is the guy who makes heroin look chic. Heroin chic is what came out of this.
And that's, we can ask ourselves a similar question regarding the United States and how these drugs are flowing into the United States, whether it's the crack cocaine of the 80s in L.A., which seemed to be part of an intelligence operation in Central America, which Gary Webb reported on. The Vietnam War, that was a big part of that, was kicking the French out and taking over the heroin trade there and shutting. That's when they decided to shut down the French connection to open up to kick the French out and open up the supply routes coming through, Indochina into Mexico. And that's what caused places like Atlantic City and Las Vegas to prosper, right?
Oddly enough, our gay mayor, he gets elected about 3 months into his term. He leaves and goes to Afghanistan. He spends 9 months in Afghanistan. So he comes back, and I said, what were you doing? Well, the official explanation, he's dealing with terrorism, money laundering, and drugs. So, wait a minute. I said, so I confronted him after a talk I gave, and I said, look, it's when the Taliban took over, heroin stopped. There was no more heroin. Then the Americans come and kick out the Taliban, and suddenly heroin's being produced again. It seems to me there's a causal connection. Well, he just dismisses this as some type of conspiracy nut. But now places like Gary and now LaPorte are just flooded with heroin. Heroin's cheaper than OxyContin now.
Mm-hmm.
Here. People are dying all over the place from overdoses. So we're talking about, I mean, there's only one place it comes from, and that place is controlled by the United States military. I mean, what conclusion are we supposed to come to here? The conclusion is that whatever it is, we didn't like it, and we voted these people out. And the question is, are the rats going to crawl back on to the ship that was supposed to sink? That's the big question, as far as I can tell, right now with the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, the Jewish lobby, AIPAC, that crowd, they're not going to go away into the night.
They took over the Congress again.
Yeah.
They passed Iranian sanctions again. That's pure AIPAC in this lame duck session. And then they passed this thing called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. I mean, this is total control by the Jews, the Jewish, the Israel lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's allowed to talk about it. So, I mean, this is another instance where the more things change, the more they remain the same. Until we're able to identify the people who are actually doing it, it's going to be business as usual. And the oligarchs will just come back under another name.
Now, I've listened to some of these analysis I've heard regarding Trump and his campaign, his victory. It signals a conflict among the oligarchs, among the ruling elite, and what course they should take. And some people interpret Trump's victory as a decision among one faction of oligarchs that America had gone too far. There is a time for some retrenchment, and perhaps some reinvestment in the United States, sort of a return to equity capitalism as opposed to financial capitalism.
Right.
And that's one positive interpretation that I can get from the election. Hopefully that there could be a time that maybe they decide to reinvest in the United States. We need to regroup, and we've gone too far. We were poking the Russian bear too much.
Right.
And so that's one, I guess, positive interpretation of the election you can get, from Trump's victory. I like to think that's the case.
So do I. It's called giving him the benefit of the doubt, yeah. And I think it's something we have to do at this point.
Yeah. So, again, for the longest time we've looked at these issues as left and right, and I think what your work points out is both left and right have pretty much been bought out, and these are ideologies that are manipulated by the oligarchs. They don't really mean much in the final analysis. They're there to manipulate you. And one thing I do appreciate your work, particularly the book I'm reading now, is, again, it provides a very very unique layered analysis, cultural, historical, these things. And again, when you're dealing with economic issues and geopolitics, it's very easy to fall into a category, left or right, and support one party versus another, some policies versus another. And one thing I've been made aware of over several years of research is the trap of dialectics, that we get caught in these things and we're being manipulated. Yeah. Words like liberty, economic freedom, free trade, sexual freedom, liberty. These things are Masonic tricks to trap us, I think.
Right, right. I agree with you.
And your work covers that. Again, your work provides a great analysis of that. And I do encourage people to read your books. However long they are great reads.
Thank you. They
have to be, because you cover so much detail and so much complexity in these things. Really makes you think. Really makes you think, because again, a lot of people either come out as for protectionism or free trade, high taxes, lower taxes. Should we cut taxes? What you handle is our issues. The issues you talk about, whether it's the psychological warfare of sexual liberation and its and how it relates to the economic policies, and this stuff doesn't get covered in electoral politics.
No,
you really have to think about this, and that's why it's very difficult. It's not like you're not going to have a campaign, someone campaigning on against sexual liberation because it's psychological warfare.
right.
But nevertheless, these things are just below the surface, and actually, probably more important because they determine the electoral politics.
That's right. They determine both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
And I think that what we saw here in this last election was their system failing. It failed. Mm-hmm. Even though it seemed it was going to go on forever, it failed. But the question is whether the new people are smart enough to not fall into the trap that these people are going to prepare for them, even though they fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's not if they're going to go away. The universities are totally in the hands of the sexual liberationist Foucauldian crowd. And they churn out people every year. Their job is to basically engage in the social engineering of young people. So
yeah, it's social engineering and predatory lending, which is actually related, I think, because if you get a young kid loaded down with debt, he's not going to start a family.
That's right. If you're not going to start a family, well, these guys think, well, let's offer homosexuality as an option. Because then we get these people totally isolated. They're just total drones, sexual robots, wage slaves, and crushed by debt. They like all that.
Yeah, they're atomized narcissists.
That's right. They're the best narcissism is itself a form of control, because the culture leads you to believe that you're powerful because you can play this video game. You know what I mean? This illusion of where you're dropping bombs and people are blowing up, or you're doing all this impossible acrobatics while you're sitting on the couch in your parents' basement loaded down with debt and afraid to talk to a girl at Starbucks.
Yeah, I've had some conversations with some younger girls about guys, how none of them know how to talk to women anymore, and they don't know how to ask them out on dates. It's a lost art.
Let's get down to brass tacks. One of the most courageous things you can do is walk up and talk to a girl, right?
Yeah, learn that.
Let's get back to the real rite of passage in Philadelphia in the 1960s. You're at a dance and you got to go ask the girl to dance. I mean, that takes real courage.
Yeah.
That takes real courage. And people who even admit the guy who came up with reparative therapy, he talked about it in exactly those terms. This type of fundamental act of courage that you have to commit as a male by approaching a female, knowing that you might be shot down or humiliated or something like that, you know, and how homosexuality is just a form of cowardice in this regard.
Yeah, because you have to learn to deal with that sort of rejection with a certain degree of dignity and alacrity, and you never develop that skill if you don't. Also, if you don't have a father and a mother to provide a model for a proper, you know, relationship. To me, that, you know, family life is what we call sexual education, what it should be, right?
Yes.
Normal, healthy family life, not this mechanistic, weird perversion that they teach today, which is designed to do the very thing, atomize and create atomized narcissists.
Right.
That's the real – but again, that's the whole level of another black op where they worked decades ago. They implemented programs that are designed to destroy that structure.
That's right.
You know, the authoritarian personalities was pretty much explicit in that regard, wasn't it?
That's right. And there's still a remnant of consciousness there that has repudiated this. So let's hope for the best.
Yes.
Let's hope for the best. Because let's face it, who are the real heroes now? The young people who are starting families.
Yeah.
You know, taking that courage, the guy who took the courageous step of talking to the girl and the developed relationship, they got married, and now they're starting families in a culture that hates them for that fact.
And does
anything within their power to make life difficult for them.
And the greatest cure for narcissism is having a baby and taking care of that baby. And starting a family is the ultimate entrepreneurial endeavor, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Because it all rests on that, which is why it's been so targeted. You know, they,
yes.
That's why. So, well, Dr. Jones, I want to thank you for coming back on the show. I think we had a wonderful talk tonight. I guess you have a recent edition of Culture Wars magazine came out, right?
The December issue is now
out. Yeah, and what's the main topic on that magazine this month?
We're talking about the metaphysical foundations of the political order. So it's not exactly the National Enquirer.
Yeah, you have a review of Christopher Simpson's book in there, I just saw.
Yeah, I reviewed Christopher Simpson's book. I sent him a copy of the review. He wrote a book called Political Illiberalism. I disagreed with a lot of what he said in the book, but we had a real polite and profitable email exchange. So I think it's worth dealing with these issues.
And you also have an article on Christian Zionism?
Yeah, Bobson Jenner's got an article on that, which really gets to the heart of the whole matter. Exposing the theological fraud behind dispensationalism and the Scofield Bible and things like that. So, yeah, it's worth the effort.
And that is, you can get a copy for $4. You can subscribe for $35 a year, is it?
Yeah, and you can get it electronic or paper versions. And, you know, you can just go to the Culture Wars website and sign up.
And I heard you were working on a new book.
I'm doing a book on Julius Nyerere. I just got back from some time in this summer, early in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be Julius Nyerere proposed for sainthood by the Bishop of Musoma, the previous bishop, not the current bishop. I got to interview the current bishop, got to go to Musoma and travel around Tanzania. It was like opened my eyes. I've never been in a place like this before. I've been to Kenya. Kenya and Tanzania are like night and day. They're completely different places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also going to be about the failure of development economics.
Yes.
Which will deal with the issues that I've already mentioned. What happened in the aftermath of Helmut Schmidt, you know, deciding that we're going to outsource everything and lower wages, and what happened in terms of development in Africa as a result of that.
Great.
So it's a real interesting topic, kind of like the sequel to Barren Metal.
Yeah,
on a real particular issue, namely development economics, which no one talks about anymore, because it's basically a Christian concept. Mm-hmm. In a sense, why would you feel obliged if you show up in a country where the people are in primitive conditions? Why would you feel obliged to raise their level of their economic ability? Because you're a Christian, because Jesus Christ told you to feed the poor and clothe the naked. And this is simply a way of doing that. And so when the Europe lost its Christianity, missionary work underwent a crisis, and that's sort of what we're talking about here. So it deals with Harry Knowles, among other groups.
And they were subverted by intelligence agencies as well. So
these. If you're talking about the Marinoles, you're talking about them going to the other side. They were joining the guerrillas in the jungles of Guatemala.
No, I'm talking about some more like the people like Jim Jones, and he apparently had intelligence connections, and Rockefeller's efforts in China and things under the guise of missionary work and all that. You know,
the missionaries were strangers, and they were not taken in by any of these things, and they were doing good work, and they killed themselves. They were subverted by their own. They became revolutionaries. This is the other side of the coin. I mean, I spent all this time talking about CIA and America and all that. This is the other side of the story.
Very interesting, yeah.
Julius Nyerere was supporting Che Guevara in the Congo. He was the conduit for Chinese communist weapons going into the Congo, where the Cubans were trying to fight the Kasavubu, Chombe, Mobutu government there.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a real interesting topic. I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, it's a he embraced, I guess you could say, lack of a better term, he embraced some sort of like socialism, right? Nyerere.
He was a socialist. Yeah. Absolutely, no question. He called himself a Catholic, but he apparently never read Quadragesimo Anno, which says you can't be a socialist and a Catholic. Can't do it. You know? So he's kind of like, I've been beating up on people like Bill Buckley for years now. Well, he was in many ways the opposite of Bill Buckley. You know?
Interesting. Yeah. Again, it's like, I guess he was a reaction to people like Mobutu, I guess you could say, right? It was a sort of a dialectical reaction to the other side.
Mobutu was a puppet of the CIA.
Yeah.
Moise Tshombe was a puppet of the CIA, and they collaborated in the murder of Patrice Lumumba, who was the popularly elected president of the Congo at that point. And that set off a huge series of wars and instability throughout the entire country.
May I ask how long the book's going to be?
You don't know until it's written, but it's not going to be longer than Barren Metal.
Okay. So that's, you should get into development economics, missionary work, the history of the missionaries in these areas, and where it went wrong. Is that basically what the book's about?
Yeah, what happened, the collapse of development economics during this period of time.
Great. Okay, that sounds really interesting. I'll look forward to that. Okay, great. Well, that's Dr. E. Michael Jones. It's culturewars.com. And I want to thank you and wish you a good night and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Same to you.
Great. Good night then. Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye.